The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of The Signal Hour. I'm your host, Dr. Chris Martinson, a very special episode today. Look, with the recent signature of the Genius Act into law, we need to talk about digital currencies, you know, stable coins, whatever that means. And it's going to extend more into this whole new digital world that we're heading into. I think we have to have eyes wide open. Full disclosure, I don't know anything about this technology. I see it, but I've never coded a coin. I don't actually know what a token actually is. I don't even know how these things really actually work. Now, how much privacy can they really be affording to us, or even how much will we no longer have any privacy at all? These are all questions we're going to be talking about with a true expert, Aaron Day, a good friend, great individual to talk to about these things, very knowledgeable because, well, he knows a lot. So, Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you again.
Well, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at our summit again this year. You did a great, very highly well-received presentation there, and you'll be back again this year. So looking forward to that. So where do we start in this conversation? I know you have a beautiful, big, long presentation you take people through. Where do you usually start in this conversation?
I guess probably the best place to start, as things are moving very quickly, is to start by just explaining to people how our money system currently works, so that it'll make it more understandable what the risks are with what's going on with stable coins and CBDCs and all of that, is to get a good foundation of how the money system currently operates. Because a lot of people are looking at the future and worried about a future where we have digital financial surveillance, not understanding that we already have digital financial surveillance. So as an example, the way money works is our money is essentially 96% digital right now. And in fact, the way money is created is the government issues an IOU to the Federal Reserve, and then the Federal Reserve doesn't print money. They're not the Treasury Department. They're not printing hundreds, fifties. They're not minting coins. They actually create money out of thin air for the federal government in an Oracle database. So when the government is paying all of its bills, it's writing checks out of an account through the Federal Reserve in an Oracle database, which, if you think about it, that is a central bank digital currency. You have a central bank, the Federal Reserve, and, you know, essentially the government is writing checks and they're being, you know, distributed in a digital fashion. And so a lot of people aren't aware of that, or don't think about the fact that even your local bank, if you're using I don't care if it's a small bank, or if you're using Citigroup or one of the big four, all of that money is digital as well. They essentially create money out of thin air in a database as well. They use Microsoft SQL databases, they use Oracle databases, standard databases, and then they create money out of thin air backed by nothing but the reserves they have in the Oracle database at the Federal Reserve. So the whole system is fundamentally digital. Well, so what does that mean in actual practical terms? Well, so most of what people are worried about when it comes to the idea of digital money is, can it be tracked? Can it be programmed to the point where, you know, where and when I can spend my money is controlled by an algorithm that's controlled by the government or other third parties? And can I be censored? Can my money be completely and totally shut off? Those are usually the things that people worry about when they think about things like CBDCs and some of the other things that are going on. And usually they say, well, you know, we don't want to become like China. China has these things. And so, you know, this is something we have to avoid because we're America and, you know, we're the land of the free and we have, you know, money that is free from financial surveillance. Well, the truth is all three of those things already happen today with the existing system. There's no change that needs to happen from a technological perspective in order to track our financial transactions. In fact, our financial transactions are already tracked by, I've identified at least 13 different federal government programs, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'll touch on some of the big ones. I mean, you already have now the IRS working with your bank using AI surveillance to look at transactions. And what many people don't realize is that when you sign your agreement with your bank, We've all become accustomed to signing these. They're called click wrap agreements. You know what it is, the thing you scroll down to get to the bottom of the page before you click accept. Well, these are actually massive legal documents. I mean, if you actually did read them, you wouldn't sign them. And I think the average American signs 150 of these per year. And there's a reason nobody reads them, because if you were to read them, you would actually have to spend an hour a day, every single day, to actually read all of the content in these legal agreements. Well, every bank agreement has at least it has these three points in it. They can cancel your contract without cause. They can change the fees without your consent. And they can sell or share your information. And people aren't aware of this. And so they do this already. So they're already sharing this information, and they're able to share it with the IRS. They're able to share it with other third parties. So what I'm trying to say here is, again, the money's already digital, and we already are being completely surveilled by all of these different programs. In addition to the AI surveillance, we have the Bank Secrecy Act, which this is a big one. And as I've been studying this, the Bank Secrecy Act was passed in 1970. So prior to 1970, there really wasn't any financial surveillance at all in this country. But as allegedly a reaction to the problem of organized crime, they wanted to stop money laundering, so they said. And so they passed the Bank Secrecy Act. And then you fast forward, we got the Patriot Act after 9/11, and then even the CARES Act. So every time there's an emergency or some kind of event, we end up getting more financial surveillance added on, even if the event itself has nothing to do with financial transactions and has nothing to do with any of the behavior of American citizens. And so this Bank Secrecy Act has what are called Know Your Customer and anti-money laundering laws. So this is why when you go to set up a bank account, I don't use a bank account anymore, but the last time I set one up was in 2018 when I ran for political office, and I went to a bank that I'd previously had an account with. I hadn't moved, and I had to come back to the bank three different times to get the bank account approved. And they had this whole series of questions. They're asking me, tell me about your family, and you know, what kind of activities are you interested in, and all this other stuff. I found out later, because I actually asked the woman that was setting up the account, I said, why are you asking me all of this stuff? And she said, it's actually because of enhanced Know Your Customer anti-money laundering laws. So your banker's not doing this to be friendly. I mean, possibly your banker was trying to be friendly, but now they're forced to basically collect all of this data on all of their consumers. And so these Know Your Customer anti-money laundering laws have been incredibly problematic. I mean, it makes things really slow and really expensive, and it doesn't catch any crime. There was an analysis done that showed that, you know, because they always say, well, this is about stopping money laundering, this is about stopping terrorism, and they found that it catches it less than 1% of the time. So it adds billions of dollars in regulatory costs, it's a real pain and inconvenience for everyone, and it doesn't solve the intended problem.
Well, and very quickly, I mean, if the government really cared about catching fraud, what did we just find out? That they were paying hundreds of thousands of people who weren't even citizens Social Security checks. The Medicare fraud, like, they just peek at that and they find tens of billions of dollars of fraud. So the government doesn't, it's sort of a do as I say, not as I do. Government's just like shot through with fraud and abuse. But they have to make sure that you have to go back to your bank three times, because it's that important to make sure that you don't skip out on I don't even know what you'd be doing criminally with your own money, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's always been about control. So again, what I like to do is, I know you're big on first principles, and I like to always look at these things and say, well, where did this legislation come from? When was it passed? Who was responsible for it? What was it intended to stop? And I will tell you, organized crime has not been abated by the 1970 Bank Secrecy Act. Organized crime is still very much alive and well. And we sit around and we talk about cartels, and, you know, and cartels use the banking service. In fact, you can see all of these major banks, the four major banks, all have paid, you know, fees, no criminal penalties, but they've paid hundreds of millions in dollars, maybe even probably billions now in fees, because they were engaged in money laundering for cartels and for organized crime. So it didn't solve the original problem at all. But the Bank Secrecy Act, so this is one big part of it, this Know Your Customer anti-money laundering thing. This is why if you set up a crypto account, if you do anything, now it's to the point where, okay, well, you have to provide a photo ID. You have to provide a picture of yourself. I mean, it's getting to the point where now biometric information is being included in this information that's part of the Know Your Customer anti-money laundering laws. And so what I want to stress before we go into any of the new areas is that this already happens now. So your data is already being collected. Your data is already being used by the government. And we've actually consented to it because we don't read any of these agreements, although it's not as though you could actually redline the agreement and send it back to the CEO of, or the head of legal counsel at Bank of America. It's kind of a take it or leave it proposition anyway. But we've given away all these rights, and so now our data is freely being shared. It's being tracked. I'll give you one interesting example. There's something called a suspicious activity report. So you may not know this, but anyone who if you do a financial transaction of greater than $10,000, a report automatically goes to the Treasury Department. Well, about 6-8 weeks ago, the Treasury Department issued a memo, and this is in response to, I'm sure it was illegal immigration or whatever it was, but they said for specifically 30 zip codes in California and Texas, that threshold amount was reduced from $10,000 to $200. So now in those zip codes, anybody doing a transaction larger than $200, a report was automatically sent to the Treasury Department. I think so. This was under Trump. This was under his Treasury. And no law was passed. There was no technological change to do this. So understand what this means is the Treasury Department can literally write a memo and then pretty much instantly that reporting goes into effect. So that highlights how digital the system is, but also how much control they already have from a reporting perspective. And so, and you know, this is a broader issue, but a lot of people, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure as well, but you know, when Klaus Schwab and the UN were talking about doing these kinds of things, digital ID and all this other stuff, people were upset. But now all of a sudden, you know, Trump's doing things in the name of illegal immigration and not realizing that, or whatever the cause may be, not realizing that what we're doing is we're adding more surveillance that's going to be weaponized against us. So that's
So let me get the summary here, because if 92% of all money isn't what we think about, you know, coins and bills, actual physical currency, it's just electronic stuff anyway. And for you and I out here in the cheap seats, all due respect, that's where we are. We have to work for our money. That means we have to exchange our time and our experience, you know, time and goods and services for goods and services, right? Okay. So for us, it's very tangible. If I run out of money, I end up under a bridge. It's very real. But at this other level, we also see that we're the people who are in charge of creating the money in the banking system, particularly at the Federal Reserve or central bank level. Well, they just make as much as they want anytime they want for all sorts of reasons, but it's always an emergency, right? Oh no, it's a this crisis, it's a that crisis, it's a something, and oh, you don't understand, Chris, if the Fed hadn't printed there in the great financial crisis, think how bad it would have been. I'd been like, we don't know, because they didn't allow it to happen. I think a world without a Citibank and a Goldman Sachs might be a better world. You never know, right? However, the point I want to make here is that this is control is the operative word. So money is really about control. It controls my life, my time, what I do, what I can't do. And so obviously that's a political substance at that point in time, right? Because all of politics is just power in various forms. So money's power. And as you said, can I just point this out? Because I know you'll get this. This is one of my favorite things. When you go to the Federal Reserve's H4.1 report, which is their balance sheet, they say, oh, collateral held against, this is their product, the Federal Reserve notes right here. So what collateral are they holding against Federal Reserve notes? I love this one. U.S. Treasury and agency debt. So the collateral for the dollars is a dollar-based IOU. Doesn't get any better than that.
I think that's an important point that people don't realize. Our money is backed entirely by debt. So in other words, government spending is the basis for the currency itself.
Yes.
And so an important point about that is, by the way, this never works. So these are fiat currencies. That's what they're called. And they've never worked in human history. I wrote about this in my book, but the average fiat currency only lasts for about 27 years. And there are seven main reasons that they collapse: economic mismanagement, corruption, competition, war, you know, a whole variety of different things. And actually, if you look at the dollar, I mean, we actually are hitting all seven. Usually when a currency collapses, it's not because of all seven. Maybe it's, you know, two or three of the different things. I mean, you think about Zimbabwe, you think about, you know, Venezuela or Argentina before Malay and everything else, and Germany during, you know, post-World War One. And so, but we actually are truly flashing bright red on all these things. So it's important for people to know as we go through this conversation that, you know, one, the money's already digital. It's backed by debt. This debt-backed currency never works because inevitably politicians just keep on printing more and more money. On top of that, we have this whole idea of a central bank in the middle of all of this. So we have a central bank, or excuse me, the Federal Reserve is neither federal nor does it have reserves. It's actually a cartel of private banks that is printing money out of thin air and profiting, backed by debt that we have to pay, collected by taxes at force, which we also pay for. It's actually a pretty horrendous system if you think about it. And so as I was saying before, our money's tracked, but it's also already programmable, and people don't think about this either. There's a lot of, you know, and I'm going to draw some, everybody likes to draw parallels to what's going on in China. And, you know, China's always the, well, we don't want to become like China. But our money is very programmable. I'll give you a couple of examples. If you have a health savings account or an HRA, these are accounts and money that can only be spent on specific healthcare related services at certain times, and in some cases, even you can only spend that money at certain retailers. So depending upon who the program is through, you know, maybe you can use this card to buy things at CVS, but you can't buy it at Walgreens, whatever it happens to be. Well, that is programmable digital money. The largest provider of HSAs, I believe it's called Optum Bank. It is a bank. I mean, that's the hint is right there. So what does this mean? It means that they already have the ability to program and come in and change. Well, today we don't want you to be able to buy this product. Tomorrow we don't want to be able you to be able to buy this product. This already exists today within the existing system that we have. So again, no technological upgrade. The money's already programmable. Or for instance, when RFK came out and said, hey, we don't think that people on Medicaid should be able to buy sodas and sugary drinks. And everybody's all excited about this. Well, how is he going to implement that? Well, the way that he's going to implement that is food stamps or EBT cards are essentially a debit-like card issued at the state level, and they're going to add more programmability to that card, more granular programmability. So now we're getting into the realm of, okay, you can only buy this selection of items from this store. And you may say, well, hey, that sounds great when it comes to, you know, the obesity problem and the healthcare problem and everything that we have with Medicaid, but you're not going to like it when the next head of HHS says you can't buy red meat, you can only buy insect-based protein. And so this is exactly what's happening with, so every time I see people cheering on, you know, on making these kinds of decisions, I'm scratching my head because all they're actually doing is adding the technology to be able to do more surveillance and more programmability. And I've yet to find, and I certainly research it often, an example of where we've reversed course and taken away surveillance and taken away monitoring and programmability, because I haven't found it yet. It's been a complete, in fact, it's getting worse since 9/11. So we went from 1970 to 9/11, and now it just seems like every crisis we get hit with significantly more surveillance and tracking, and now AI just makes all of this worse. So the money's programmable, the money's trackable, and then lastly, we know it's censorable now too. I mean, this I've known about this for a long time. I was debanked in essence for the first time in maybe 2010, 2009 through my company. But and if you're in the crypto space, this is a common thing. But now we know, because of that Mark Andreessen interview with Joe Rogan and others, that a lot of people have been debanked. I mean, the Trump family, Melania Barron, actually the whole family, Dr. Joseph Mercola, Kanye West, others have been debanked. If you have a gun shop, or if you're in the health freedom space, or even the food freedom space, being debanked is a normal way of life for you. People have become almost accustomed to it in a way, although eagerly looking for solution. So understand that financial censorship already happens today. Again, no changes needed to the system. But one of the things that I want to point out about the censorship part of actually getting your account shut off, as I mentioned, if you look at the agreement that you have with your bank, it says they can close your account without cause. They don't have to have any justification. And usually how it works is I believe they have to give you 30 days notice to find another bank, and you can either give them, you know, the routing details for your new bank, or they'll cut you a check. I mean, it's literally that rigid of a process, and there's no appeal process. There's nothing. But understand, in this political situation, we have this situation where a lot of these politicians say, well, it's the central bank, these are the bad guys. All of the financial surveillance and all of the programmability and everything that I've just discussed was not pushed by the Federal Reserve. All of that came from Congress, or in some cases from the executive branch in an emergency order. I'm not justifying the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve absolutely should not exist, and it's an unnecessary third party. But the surveillance aspect of this comes from Congress. And the censorship, most of the censorship didn't come from the Federal Reserve or Congress. These were policies issued by the banks. And in particular, it's the large banks that tend to be very, very eager to go after people in certain industries or who express political speech that isn't aligned with a globalist technocracy agenda. So Jamie Dimon, a lot of those companies that I mentioned, you know, Kanye West, Dr. Joseph Mercola, that was J.P. Morgan Chase. The big banks are the ones that often do the censoring. So this was not pushed by law. This wasn't even pushed by the government. That censorship happened at the level of the commercial bank at their discretion, because we signed up for it when we signed our contract with the bank. So,
yeah. I don't think anything ever actually comes from Congress. Everything's written for them by other parties. And, it's pretty easy to tell what's going on, right? The PREP Act was written by the pharma industry, et cetera. So, and these laws are now, 2,000-3,000 pages thick sometimes, you know, and very dense legalese with all this stuff. You know, I discovered this when I was investigating the Great Taking, right? I looked at all this really complicated, very subtle legal machinery. That wasn't some congressman from Iowa writing that language, you know? That guy can barely make it to all his campaign trips he's got to do this next 2 years, right? So these people are doing this, they're writing all of this, but you said something very important. I want to just make sure that, let's see if we're on the same page. Fiat currencies last 27 years, there's warning signs, there's seven key ones, all of them are flashing red. Do you think that possibly some of the driver, the urgency, the speed with which things are happening, not just because AI and technology is developing quickly, but it's because somebody has a ticking clock that they know that our current U.S. dollar-based system, fiat debt-based money system, is about to go kaput? And this just came up today. Oh, I'll have to pull it up. Give me 1 second, but I'll just read it. So Marco Rubio here complaining that some countries might not be cowed by, illegal unilateral U.S. sanctions, since they're all seeking to break free from the dollar, and we can't just have that. So he's saying the solution to people trying to evade our sanctions is more sanctions. It's brain dead, obviously. But it feels like the dollar's under some real threats here, and I'm wondering if what we're seeing and feeling isn't some sort of a rush to develop a parallel system just in case, or as a hot swap, both wings being replaced mid-flight, hope for the best kind of activity.
Yeah, I think, even Bretton Woods and the whole system that we have right now was understood to be temporary. I think that actually underneath this, there's been a move towards creating a global government with a global digital currency for decades. And so this is really important. So from my perspective, we don't have a red versus blue situation, or America versus China, or America versus BRICS. There are people just carving up who's going to control what percentage of the global technocracy. And the end goal of this, these aren't even conspiracy theories. One of the things that I'm focused on the most moving forward is trying to educate people on the difference between, that the battleground here is technocracy versus freedom, and to educate people on what technocracy is, because it's not technology. So technocracy is essentially, it's a form of governance. It's a reordering of how the world works, where you have scientists and engineers who are picked by elites, and they're making decisions for everyone. So the idea here is, you know, we're too stupid to make decisions in our own life, and the whole planet is going to self-destruct because of CO2. And then the only way we're going to be able to fix this is to have the smartest scientists and engineers solving the problem. And so one of the first ways that they want to do this is by changing the entire economic system to a system based on price, to a system based on energy credits. And this is literally an idea that goes back to the 1930s. And I encourage people to take a look at the work of Patrick Wood, who's been writing about these things for decades. I mean, you can actually see the organization. They all wore gray suits, to the point where GM made a paint color called Technocracy Gray. And they've been pushing for this centralized global order based on an energy credit-based system. And things are actually moving very quickly to that. But to your point, do I think that they know that the dollar is failing? But the thing that's the most bizarre to me is that, you know, if insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, if we know with thousands of examples that fiat currency hasn't worked, why are we continuing this model? Like this idea of, well, is it going to be BRICS next, or is it going to be China? Is it going to be the yuan? I will tell you this, whatever, if that's the model we're going to, that's going to fail too, because debt-based currency is what creates the boom and bust cycle of nations. And so we need to kind of move beyond that. But I think we're in the late stage. I think they're very aware. I mean, if you look at what was going on in the economy in 2019, before COVID even hit, I mean, you already had some issues at the Federal Reserve. You had hedge funds that were about to collapse. People don't even want to talk about this. This gets shoved completely under the rug. But we were heading into serious economic turmoil in 2019 and COVID. So we're kind of going from crisis to crisis, Ponzi to Ponzi, and which we'll get into. Stablecoins are the next way, the next Hail Mary that the administration is using to try to be able to sell more treasuries and to maintain the global reserve status of the dollar.
All right, we'll get into that, the stablecoin bit in just a second. I want to make sure I have the landscape right. So listen, you're aware, I'm aware. In fact, anybody who's just, it's not even just us at this point. Common knowledge is sort of broken out, right? We've had Jamie Dimon come out and say there's going to be some sort of an accident in the bond market. We've had Ray Dalio talking about this. Obviously, it's not hard. Honestly, it's pathetically easy to just note that when you get over leveraged, there aren't that many ways to conclude that story. The problem is we have a debt-based fiat system, particularly operated as the United States has done it, where the debts are growing at about twice as fast as the underlying economy. It's unsustainable, right? Jerome Powell said that. So we all know that, right? And obviously we're going to try and perpetuate this a little longer, and I'm interested how stablecoins might help them actually sell more treasuries, because it sounds like an artful dodge, but doesn't really do that for long as far as I can tell, but maybe I don't understand it. But the problem I have with all this is that it's really easy to resolve that the way we're operating our current system is going to break. Now, Trump and Bessent understood that. I saw them on the campaign trail. I know what they were talking about in January. And then we've had that about face. Now it's a big, beautiful bill, and it's all spending, you know, increases with cuts, you know, structured out 4 or 5 years from now. That felt a little bit like they just threw the towel in on that whole enterprise and went for one more kick at the can. Do you read that any differently at this point, or am I missing something?
No, I mean, that's exactly what it is. I mean, and we're at the point where they're feigning peace through strength, or they're trying to act like we're overly strong when in reality we are incredibly weak. And so this is why with everything that they're doing, not only with tariffs, but even with the Genius Act and the stablecoin legislation, what's frustrating is you watch the language around it. It's, you know, America's, you know, we're great. We're the, you know, it's the golden age. We are the most powerful nation in the world. We're going to have this big, robust economy. And then in reality, what we're doing is we're adding more spending than we ever had. We're adding more debt than we ever have. And then behind the scenes, it's like that there's that Homer Simpson meme where, you know, he looks thin in front and then you see that, you know, behind he's got clothespins and, you know, he's got the fat all behind him. I mean, that's essentially how they're approaching the way that they're, the language on, well, we're strong, but what they're trying to do is they're trying to push one more kind of Ponzi. And again, the stablecoin thing is the Ponzi, which I didn't even fully realize until probably the last 6 to 8 weeks, because this wasn't a big part of the messaging, but now I see exactly what they're trying to do with it. And so, yeah, we're in desperate straits because we have $37 trillion in debt. We're going to be adding $2.5 trillion for at least the next 2 years, and our debt's been downgraded, and China has said it's time to ditch the dollar. People don't want to buy our debt. So if we're increasing the debt, and people don't want to buy it, they had to come up with some other alternatives, and they have. And I hope it doesn't work, because not only are we going to be funding and selling more treasuries and adding more to the debt, but we're also going to be adding more surveillance and more programmability. We're essentially going to get backdoor CBDCs while also expanding the debt and funding government tyranny around the world.
We're in a very unsustainable situation with debt. And it's not just, you know, a lot of times when I talk about the United States debt situation, the $37 trillion comes up, which is federal debt. I've had Mitch Fexler on. He says there's another $5 trillion of completely unpayable municipal debt out there because it's just been Ponzi'd on top of real estate taxes, and they just rolled debt hey hosanna forever. But eventually you find these ridiculous numbers, you know, like billions being owed by a few thousand households in this little, you know, school district in Texas. It's just awful. We also have overall $103 trillion of debt in the U.S. system right now. And at some point that has to be paid back. Now, you know, my main thesis in life is that you don't pay back future stuff from nothing. It's from future economic growth. And when you peel back that cover one layer, you go, well, what's an economy? It's you getting on a plane. It's me cutting down a tree and selling some wood. It's something, something. When you peel it back even further, it's energy. Most shocking thing to me, the EIA came out this year and it said, oh, yeah. Yeah, the shale's at peak, and you know, whether it bumps along till 2027 or maybe through 2026, we don't really know. And then it just tails off forever. That should be the most shocking news ever, really, for an infinite growth paradigm where we're counting on paying back that $103 trillion out of the future. And the future, well, where's that energy going to come from? Nobody can answer that question right now, and they're not gonna. It's the most obvious, simple, adult, prudent conversation you should have,
and
we're just not having it.
AI will fix it. That hand waving AI, problem solved, right? That's the new one.
AI will think of something. That's the hope, right? Yeah, that's the bargaining phase of this emotional adjustment. But so given that, it seems what I'm just trying to drive to here, Aaron, is the conclusion is very deductive, simple to come to. The current system is going to fail. And what you're saying is they have a plan. And the plan is to lock us all into like digital prisons as fast as possible, so at least they can maintain control over the plebes while keeping resources for themselves. I don't know. I don't understand the plan at all, because I don't see the mechanism for it actually working in my head. But let's start there. What's this big push all about?
So there are two things. One, I know what their end state is. Now, whether it'll work or not is a separate thing, but they certainly will try it. And I mean, because we see this, you know, all of the time, and we've seen this in China. We saw this in the Soviet Union, where it's not as though these kinds of centralized approaches haven't been tried before. But that doesn't discourage people from trying it again. And of course, now they're emboldened by this idea that they think that they know what the problems are, and that, you know, because of science and technology, we're going to be able to fix it this time. Whereas, of course, other times, it was also science and technology that was supposed to solve things in the Soviet Union and China, and it didn't then either. And in fact, it probably will have even more dire consequences. But if you want to understand what the world looks like under this technocratic system, imagine now you have a digital currency that is backed by energy credit. So this is the new global currency. So everything that you do is termed in the energy usage. And then look at the UN Agenda 2030 and the 17 Sustainable Development Goals that they have. So they want to tackle everything from water to poverty to equality. They want to manage basically the land, the air, and the sea. If you actually dig down into the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, it's managing every facet of our lives. Well, so now imagine you have this energy credit system. And now these 17 Sustainable Development Goals are essentially elements of a social credit system that are then tied into the energy credit system. So with incentives and penalties from the top down. So you get water credits, you get educational credits, you get healthcare credits, and all of this is tied and integrated into this energy credit-based system. This is essentially the model that they're working towards, and this actually started – and. This isn't even speculation. The technocracy movement started in the 1930s, and then David Rockefeller and Brzezinski picked it back up when they started the Trilateral Commission in 1973. And then what they did was they helped draft the UN New International Economic Order in 1974. And that essentially has become the basis for the UN Agenda 2030. I mean, obviously a lot of iterations and everything from there. But when I say that there's a push for technocracy, that is literally what the design has been all along. And so we are, but we're further along than this. What I like to say to people is we're not moving towards a digital prison. We're already 90% in the digital prison, and we're not aware that we're in the prison. We're already in the matrix, right? They're already tracking our financial transactions. The money's already programmable. And to use this example with China again, people say, oh, I saw this horrible thing about China where they have this social credit system and there's an app and they can't get in and out of places and everything's being tracked. Well, we have a social credit system in the United States. It is the 75,000-page, 16-million-word tax code. What is the tax code? The tax code is a system of incentives and penalties where you're either rewarded or punished for various behavior. The difference is we don't have an app. So, and of course, no one could read 16 million words. In fact, even tax professionals have a hard time keeping up with the tax code. So we're sitting here without an app, and if we're wrong, we go to prison. And why are we going to prison? To collect money on those IOUs to pay the Federal Reserve. This is, so when I say we're already in a prison, this is present day America. We just don't have a shiny app. The app arguably would be better because at least we'd have more transparency. We already have this system of a high level of top-down control, but it can get worse and it will get worse. One of the things that frightens me the most is last year, people were really interested in learning about the threat of CBDCs. People were talking about how horrible it would be if we would have a digital ID, and people were worried about AI surveillance. And if you throw Klaus Schwab's name on it or Bill Gates's name on it, then, you know, this is a horrible thing. What's happened in the first 6 months of the Trump administration is worse than anything that happened in the Biden administration and is something that Kamala Harris couldn't accomplish in two terms. And I want you to think about it this way. So we have Real ID now, which the Real ID program was started in 2005. It was signed under George W. Bush, and this actually goes back to, you know, it's from 9/11 to passing the Real ID. But it took 20 years. I mean, I don't have a Real ID, but because every time it would come up, I mean, you've been able to get a Real ID for quite some time, and I always punted on it, thinking, ah, well, you know, they're just going to kick the can on this. It wasn't until Trump got in office where they were actually able to finally push Real ID over the finish line. And once again, what is the rationalization for it? You know, and unfortunately, I mean, MAGA will say, oh, well, I understand we have issues with voting and we have issues with illegal immigration. So they'll cheer this on, not understanding how this will be weaponized when it is a different administration with a different set of values and a different ideology, and the technology and the tracking won't go away. Well, Real ID, which if you've gotten a Real ID, you have to bring a birth certificate, a social security card, you have to bring all of this information, and all that information is tied into this ID. And of course, the government has all of that information digitally, and now in 8 states, Real ID is already digital. So you can actually tie your Real ID to a Google wallet or an Apple wallet, and now this is expanding. So in essence, we've now launched and started implementing digital ID under Trump. We have with Palantir, you know, Trump announces, oh, we're going to build a database on Americans. But one of the things that happened when Doge was, I guess Doge still exists, but one of the things when it was still under Elon's direction is they gave an API, which is essentially a way of giving access to Palantir to get at our tax records. And now what they're doing with this database is they're basically going to connect into all of the federal government databases and collect all of the information on all U.S. citizens. And then that's going to be tied into your Real ID. So this is stuff that's actually happening now. I mean, this is stuff that, you know, the one thing that I'll say, Biden was great, like on the crypto front, he was great at lawfare, but wasn't good at actually implementing a CBDC. The problem is the technocrats, the PayPal mafia that's kind of pulling the strings with the Trump administration, people like Peter Thiel, David Sachs, Elon Musk, all of them ex-PayPal, they're very good at doing this. They've been building these systems and creating this kind of technology for decades. And so now we're much closer to actually the finish line than the starting line, because we already have digital versions of these things in place. And as an example, people are celebrating the TSA saying, well, you know, you no longer have to wear shoes when you're going through the airport, but yet they're adding new surveillance. So you don't have to wear, you don't have to take your shoes off, because they're going to be able to track using other surveillance and other means. Part of this
I want to connect this around, because, you know, I did a lot of work on COVID. And so one of the things I saw that got pulled out, and I had to go into this whole side detour to understand a concept called fifth generation warfare, which is the where warfare is, you know, we think warfare, we think bullets and spears and arrows and bombs and stuff, but that's not it. Fifth generation warfare is all the way back up the field to the point where what they're doing is they're going after your cognition. And so we've already seen that somebody has the power, Aaron, to tunably direct people's 2 minutes of hate from Black Lives Matters to Ukraine to not wearing your mask to hating Elon. So we've seen that is very powerful, you know, golf claps. It's pretty impressive. But what we're talking about here is that they came out with the nudge units. We start to saw some of their power, and they use those to coerce people. And I'm going to use that word very carefully, to coerce people to take shots. Right. And they did it through a combination of shame, social isolation, attacking their ability to earn money, whatever. They had a variety of tools. But the point was, they didn't just come up and put a gun to your head and say, get the shot or else. People could react to that. It was these nips and nudges that ended up pushing things in a direction. So that's the way they do social engineering now, is with these nips and nudges. So back to your tax code, you know, 16 million words. Those provide incentives and disincentives. Those are nudges, right? But it's kind of clunky, because once a year you sit down and nobody quite knows, and maybe you get it wrong anyway. But if you have an app for that, Aaron, if I'm getting nipped and nudged on a daily basis, they will push me in a direction. I don't know if anybody can resist it. I really don't.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. You can resist it. You have to exit the systems now. I mean, one of the things that I've been saying for quite some time is you're not going to be able to vote our way out. You have to stop, which is what I've done. I've stopped using the dollar. I've stopped using the banking system. You have to unplug from public health. You have to unplug from media. But we have to do it now. This is not we don't have time, because the challenge with this is, you're right, what they use are what are called salami tactics, slice by slice. So they add new surveillance. Again, we have this emergency, and this seems disconnected. We have COVID. Well, why are we getting financial surveillance because of COVID? I don't know, but nobody questions that part of it. People are still litigating COVID itself and not realizing, hey, remember when they put in GPS tracking on people? Remember that? I mean, you know, that should be pretty frightening. Remember when they added all this new financial surveillance? Remember when they got rid of, you know, it used to be that the Federal Reserve had to have 10% in reserves, or there used to be 10% reserve requirements, excuse me, for banks. Mm-hmm. And that got wiped out under the CARES Act. Well, they never
March 26, 2020. I remember the date. It was on the Federal Reserve website. They're like, oh yeah, we're not doing reserve requirements anymore. And they just dropped it on the website. And I was like,
they never dropped it. And as to fifth generation warfare, I mean, this is a big part of what I'm doing. I mean, what I'm doing now is I'm focusing on trying to educate people about technocracy, but then focusing people on an autonomy reboot, which is that we've got to exit these systems. The battle here is for free will itself. They want to be able to program everything, and we're all programmed. I mean, so let's face it, we're all programmed either from, you know, whatever happens when we're a kid, when we have no conscious filtering, to school. You know, school is a big, you know, part of the indoctrination, and, you know, depending upon where, you know, where you grew up, religion and the media and everything else. But one of the scariest ways, I mean, to your point about this with fifth generation warfare, is the ability to use technology to program people. So we have to teach people that they've been programmed, to first become awake and aware of the fact that they've been programmed, and then to go and, you know, overwrite the programming or take control of their own programming. Because if you're not in conscious control of your own free will, that means somebody else is. And what this technology allows various entities to do is to target this at a really granular level. And no one understands that better than Elon Musk. And I've been trying to find this clip, and I will find it eventually. This was years before he bought Twitter. I remember him, he was actually talking about, you know, in a way, how evil the big tech companies were and the social media companies are, because in essence, what they're doing is they're hijacking our limbic system. And I've spent a lot of time studying this, going all the way back to Bernays, Edward Bernays, and the whole history of propaganda, which is a, it's a fascinating, there's a documentary, I think, from the BBC that I just, well, if I think about it, I'll, four-part documentary on kind of the history of this kind of thing, on propaganda and how it works. And so the whole idea was, yeah, they've been trying to manipulate people's subconscious. They've been trying to create demand. And at first, this happened coming out of World War II, because at least the way they justified it was, well, the way we're going to defeat communism is through consumerism. And the way to make consumerism work is to manipulate people at a subconscious level and to make them want to buy products, and doing all kinds of techniques and everything. And this actually goes all the way back to Freud using these techniques. Well, the modern techniques are much more sophisticated. There was an example, this guy Delgado, who put an implant in a bull and was able to use a remote control to actually stop and control the behavior of the bull. Well, what they realized, and this was decades and decades ago, was you don't even need the implant. You can actually use different frequencies without an implant. So now, as we move forward, everything from, and you and I started talking about this on the phone a few weeks ago, but the blue light that comes from our monitors, this actually manipulates our dopamine systems. The blue light also actually raises insulin levels. So when we start looking at things like 5G and what's going on with blue light and the underlying technology itself, before we even talk about the algorithms that are built on top of it. And so this is a really dangerous component of it. And Musk knows it. Musk, you know, and I frankly, I believe, you know, he's hijacked it as well for his own purposes. I mean, you look at some of the stuff that's going on. Do we think that it was an accident that all of a sudden Grok 3 started going into this, you know, other mode where it was saying things that were otherwise politically incorrect? Do we really think that was an accident? Or was that an intention to try to galvanize a set of people around the America Party? You know. But the bottom line is this: we have to recognize that all of this is programming, and we have to make a conscious decision that we are going to take our free will back, because if we don't, then we don't have a choice. So, and if we do at least make that decision to take our free will back, then we begin the process of building parallel systems, which I think is the way out of this, is not voting our way out of it or working even within the system. It's building alternatives that are outside of all of these institutions that are all marching and moving very aggressively towards a one global technocracy.
Well, I agree. And the reason that, you know, outside of the walls of the studio, there's a farm with cows and chickens and things like that. And the reason I preach resilience so often is because I have a deep humility around my inability to understand complex systems. I just know I'm surrounded by them. As a scientist who studied cells, each cell is this unbelievably complicated thing, right? When all those people came out during COVID, like, we understand the immune system. Like, no, we don't. No, we do not. It's highly complicated nested system. So here's my belief system. I might be wrong, Aaron, but I'm not confused. The technocrats think that they can control everything. It's reductionistic. It's linear. It's like more control. They can control. I think they're going to try and control the uncontrollable, because fundamentally complex systems like life, like economies, like everything in our world have a couple of features. One of them is you can't predict them. Another one is they have emergent behaviors. And so the idea that they're going to be able to just control this all the way down to their deepest fantasy, where they control every little micron of movement and get the utopia that I think they're envisioning, the chance of that failing, the chance of them actually breaking the very thing they're trying to control, is as close to 100% as anything I can imagine.
I agree with that. But I think, to even go one step further, it's important for people to understand that behind technocracy is a belief in materialism and determinism. This is what the ideology is. So if you're a person of faith at all, if you have any religious beliefs at all, this system is completely anti any of that. By design. I mean, if you want to get into the level of to which they believe this stuff, I mean, if you've heard of Stephen Wolfram, who's been big in AI, Wolfram Alpha, and all of these other things. I mean, his whole view is that we're just a deterministic system, and he's been working for 40 years to try to figure out, because he believes he'll be able to get to a point where he can predict every decision, every movement, everything that can be made, everything that goes on in the physical world. And he's failed. I mean, so far he's completely failed, but he's been working at it for 40 years. So the underlying ideology of this, whether it's Musk or Thiel or, you know, and we can get into some of the other people behind it. Actually, if it's whether it's Yuval Harari on the left or Curtis Yarvin is a guy pushing this on the right, they're both underneath pushing technocracy and pushing this idea of materialism and determinism. And I think that it's not even cutting edge science. I mean, even if you were going to look at cutting edge science, if you look at quantum physics versus, you know, Newtonian physics, it's not, you know, they're actually using a hundred-year-old model. They're not even using cutting edge science, but they're trying to claim that it's science. But this is where this ultimately ends up going. They don't believe in free will. We've heard Harari say the era of free will is over. They don't even value free will. So this is why we get to a point where, which to me, I believe this is what all of this is about. I think this is actually a battle for free will itself and consciousness and our ability to exercise our own agency. This worldview doesn't believe in the concept of free will. And so, you know, the end state of this is some, it's kind of like that movie WALL-E where, well, we're going to have AI and it's going to generate a lot of wealth for the people that are left. And it's going to be this complete hedonistic lifestyle. Musk has even made comments about that. It'll be great. And I think that that misses the mark, in my opinion, about the fundamental nature of reality and consciousness.
Well, even beyond that, there's a whole other existential problem that's stacking up right now. It's very clear to me that AI is going to be able to do a good number of the jobs that humans used to do, all right, or still do, but soon formally used to do. Okay, so we cut over, say, okay, let's imagine we get to AI utopia, right? Robots, building robots and very efficiently manufacturing goods and services so that humans can just sit back and like in WALL-E, you know, we're hanging out on our Barca loungers that are floating around. Okay, if we take them all the way to that moment, we have all these studies from Mousetopia that suggest that when a social creature is devoid of meaning and purpose, they just check out. They just, you give up. Like it becomes nihilistic at that point. So fundamentally, the thing you're talking about is a highly, deeply nihilistic point of view, which says there is no point in existing at all. Which yep. then allows Hariri to say things like useless eaters. I'm almost positive when he says free will is over, he means for you. I'm pretty sure he thinks his free will is going to stay intact. I think that's how these people operate. It's very hierarchical. They always worry about other people. Remember, misinformation in earnest is because we're worried about how some other people might misinterpret stuff. Not me, you know.
But I think what's important about this is that this same ideology is coming from the right, and it's coming from this guy Curtis Yarvin, who's actually been promoting the idea of a neo-monarchy. It's also all about hierarchy. And this is what, and this guy Yarvin, I encourage people to look into this.
Isn't that communism, though? It's the same thing. There's a very small group of elites who run the whole system, and everybody else sort of is a feeder into that system.
Yes, and it's actually influenced even libertarians. And so the way that they pitch it, it kind of like it's tapping into a whole bunch of different things. But it's like, yeah, well, you need to have hierarchy, but this is a hierarchy based on competence. So in essence, the head of a country needs to be like a monarch or like a CEO. And so a lot of what you're seeing when you see libertarian people, you know, publishing things about, you know, race and IQ and everything else, all of this stems from what Yarvin is pushing. And Yarvin has influenced J.D. Vance, Peter Thiel, and Elon Musk to the point where Elon Musk actually consulted with him before forming the America Party. So people need to understand what the ideology is that's pushing this. This is why I say it's technocracy versus freedom. And if people aren't looking at what technocracy is and aren't understanding what all that's about, then you're going to look at day-to-day events as being isolated examples, or you'll find people to say things like, well, you know, what's wrong with this? I mean, these are successful guys. They're just applying technology to make government more efficient. And that's not what the agenda is. They're actually pushing a very specific worldview. And the problem is when those same people control things like Palantir and they control things like X, they have the ability to engage in that fifth generation warfare. So there becomes a really interesting question that I've been thinking about, which is, well, we talk a lot about informed consent. Well, how much informed consent do we have about our manipulation through these social media systems? And what do we do to address that? Because I could see a situation where people vote for technocracy, but did they really vote for technocracy if they were manipulated using these algorithms and using these systems?
I just pulled up Curtis Yarvin because I'm going to have to look into that. But isn't it, I mean, so okay, the ideology is important. We can all feel it. Aaron, there's this big muscular push in a direction, and that direction is always more control over my life with fewer freedoms left for me, right? With, I think, some sort of nirvana state where they believe that they don't even have to peer into my life because they already know what I'm thinking because it's all deterministic. Okay, fine. But that's where we're pushing, is this whole thing, and it takes us away from free will, which means this is fundamentally a spiritual battle, right? Because the Bible fundamentally says that God expects you to approach him from a place of free will, right? It has to be your own free choice. If no free choices exist, then there's no God. Then there's no point to any of this stuff. This is deeply nihilistic. I wonder if this isn't just what happens when a species kind of gets, you know, begins to run out of resources and goes crazy and does these weird deflective behaviors to try and make sense of the world around them, or because this just smells like communism to me, 100%, you know. And by the way, editorially, if minutia oriented regulatory oversight by a technocratic elite worked, Europe would be kicking ass right now. And they're not. So
no, they're, yeah, no, they're not.
Is it just we have better technology? We're going to do a better version of that this time. Is that, it's just that conceit.
It is that conceit. I mean, and these are people, I mean, again, when you look at Rockefeller and you look at the formation of these organizations and the people behind it, their view is, well, the plebs really can't help themselves. We're going to have to solve these things for them. And they understood that it was a long-term plan, and now they're close to being able to execute it. And to tell, I mean, look, they've done really well on the energy credit front. I play, there's a, you can go to YouTube and you can type in Doconomy MasterCard, Doconomy. This is an amazing thing that people voluntarily signed up for, that it's a MasterCard that tracks your carbon and then it shuts off when you use too much carbon. And so people sign up for this. And so MasterCard has been behind the scenes for years, forming relationships with large multinational corporations where they're now tracking your financial purchases and the carbon impact of this. And so they're building this system. And then, of course, in schools, they've been scaring people, kids, with climate alarmism to the point where kids don't want to reproduce and have a complete, you want to talk about nihilism. The nihilism is being pushed through climate alarmism. And the climate alarmism originally emanated from this group called the Club of Rome, where when you read their documentation, they said they were making it up. So it was an original design. It's that problem, reaction, solution, generate some fear so that we can push this technocratic system in. So behind it, the people that are actually pushing the technocracy don't believe what they're saying. They're literally using propaganda and censorship to push their view so that we end up with this, you know, I think dystopian, deterministic, top-down system that pretty much destroys free will.
No, that's unfair, Aaron. These people who care about climate change, I saw them, they all assembled for Jeff Bezos's wedding, and clearly everybody flying, and they didn't jet pool, they all flew their individual private jets over there, and then later we got lectures on climate change, because again, it's that elitism, right? It's rules for thee, not for me. Listen, I'm very worried about this world, but fundamentally my worry means I'm going to have to control you and lock you down. I'm fine. My yacht, my mega yacht's fine.
So to that point, I think read up on Curtis Yarvin, because
yeah,
Curtis
I just
Yarvin,
wanted to bring that up because you mentioned him. So I found him here. This is a Curtis Yarvin right here. He had a tweet just went out 6 hours ago here, but this was to your point here. Said Elon Musk consulted Curtis Yarvin, right wing thinker, on third party. So this is the gentleman here.
So this guy is the Yuval Harari. He's the Yuval Harari of the right. And when you really dig into what he's saying, he's saying the exact same thing as Harari. They're just spinning it from the right. So at the end, you get technocracy. At the end, you get elitism. They're pitching elitism as something that happens as a kind of, I guess it's Jordan Peterson talks about, you know, competence hierarchies. And so they're trying to push it as a merit. It's a merit-based hierarchy. But the problem with it is that, again, you don't get a choice in it. I think it's fine if you're starting a company and you're doing whatever you want to do voluntarily. I mean, yeah, that makes sense. You're going to do whatever you're going to do. But if you're trying to hijack countries and then manipulate people, using social engineering to accept a technocracy, that's the dividing line. The dividing line in all of these cases is consent. And we have a complete lack of consent across the board in society, obviously in healthcare, but I think we have we may even have an even bigger problem when it comes to what's going on with social media and information. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that government fix this. I don't have any answers to it yet, but it's kind of what can we do privately around this idea of informed consent around social media and all of this tech that's going on. And I don't have an answer, but I'm going to be spending some time researching that.
All right. I have a question for you then. So I have a paradigm that says actually it's the West that's under attack, right? Our culturally, we're under attack, our mores, our values. And again, back to the WEF in 2016, they were very kind. They put out a little short video, which famously number one was you'll own nothing and be happy. But number eight was by 2030, Western values will have been tested to the breaking point. Not African values, not Asian values, not Indian values, you know, Western values. This technocracy that you're exposing here, it feels kind of Western centric. Do you see this rolling out? Do they have plans for Vietnam, Indonesia, Argentina, or is this just really, just going to be foisted upon the Five Eyes?
No, it's actually global. I mean, if you look at, so again, the vector for how these things get pushed out are through organizations like the UN. So the UN is all encompassing. And by the way, where do you have tech? You have technocracy more evolved in China than anywhere else. So it certainly is not a Western thing. In fact, I remember when, you know, wasn't it that Biden or somebody, I mean, it may have been Trump, but I think it was Biden that was praising the COVID lockdown measures that were going on in China, their ability to lock people in their apartments. And then they had all of the, you know, the people dressed in full garb trying to, you know, spray and everything else. I know that at least from our country and other places in Europe, people were fawning over the Chinese ability to work on containment of COVID, which should be a bit frightening. So no, it's not a Western thing at all. It's completely global. And in fact, one of the things about this is because I talk to a lot of people and their approach is, well, hey, I can go hide in a cabin in the woods. And it's just, but you really can't. There's no competition. You can't. Technocracy doesn't exist alongside other systems because, as again, when you look at what the UN's trying to do, they want to regulate all of the assets of the planet. It's a global climate crisis. So you don't get to opt out if you're Vietnam or you don't get to opt out if you're in New Hampshire. They specifically push these things on a global basis. And so this is why, to me, all of this comes down to it is about technocracy versus freedom. And if you had to boil it all down, it really is truly a battle over free will. And when you look at Curtis Yarvin is an atheist. Yuval Harari is an atheist. And when you track and research what's pushing, what the ideology is, because people don't see, you know, I mean, you see Harari somewhat. Most people don't see Yarvin yet. I hope more do, and I hope more appreciate that people on the right are buying the exact same outcome and the exact same thing that Yuval Harari is selling. They're just packaging it up a little bit differently, but the end result is exactly the same, and the end purpose and ideology is exactly the same. We right now don't have any competing forces. We just have two different sides manipulating the mass population and technocracy flourishing, which is why I say we now have Real ID, we have Palantir AI surveillance, and we're about to have CBDCs through this stablecoin legislation at a level that would not have ever been possible if it were pushed directly as a CBDC. They're basically capturing something that's already popular, and then they're putting it under control of the government.
So when I said Western values then, and you mentioned China already has sort of like this technocracy installed, and they're certainly advancing it at a breakneck clip. But China's core ideology is one of collectivism, right? And so G. Edward Griffin and wrote Creature from Jekyll Island. Is that what I see behind you there? And he talks about the collectivist versus the individualist, right? And so individualism is a Western value, right? I'll go out into the cabin in the woods, right? So that has to be broken. So it really feels like this is the big push. What somebody decided a long time ago, you know what we need? We need to operate this like one world. It's like World Inc. And the best way to do that is in a collectivist approach, because the best way to do that, of course, is you would have some highly competent people right at the top running everything, you know, because you can't trust people. We already know that, right? And then we'll just administer this whole thing. And then I don't know what happens next. Nirvana. We get to, it's the oldest story in the book. Aaron, I can't find a single period in history where that's worked out. It works for a little while on paper, but it really doesn't work out in terms of human flourishing, prosperity, good outcomes, often ends in mass atrocities.
It usually ends in mass atrocities, but tens of millions of people dying or starving. This is typically how this works. And so I think the consequences will be actually more dire now because, you know, the difference this time is that, oh, well, the technology is better. We have AI, so on and so forth. But when this kind of centralization has been tried in the past, the centralization has been confined to a country, to a single country. This centralization that's going on right now is happening at a global level. So if a country tries this and fails, well, there are other countries. There are people existing with other, you know, forms of government and other belief systems around the world. This is actually centralizing globally one thing. So this is why it has the potential to be a, you know, an existential threat to humanity if it goes wrong. Because if you put that much, you know, yeah, if 30 million people die because of starvation, you know, in China, that's one thing. But if it's the globe and now people are centrally administering and determining how food supply works, food production works and everything else, then where do you go? Then what's your plan B?
Mars? Just joking.
Yeah,
obviously.
Yeah.
For all eight of them, you know, yeah, the rest of you, sorry. All right. Well, Aaron, we're going to leave it there for today. And we're going to do this in a part two. And part two for everybody, I really want to go into, you know, what are these stable coins? What are the signs we're going to be looking out for to see, you know, as these things develop and develop very rapidly? But most importantly, how do we protect ourselves and what can we really do to step aside if that's a choice we want to make? Which I certainly do, obviously. So with that, Aaron, thanks so much for your time today. Where can people go to? I know you've got lots of materials out there.
The best place now, and I'm reorganizing it continually, is daylightfreedom.org. That's where you can see, you know, articles, books, podcasts, everything else. I also have my podcast, The Aaron Day Show, which is every Thursday at 8 p.m., and then I'm also at brownstone.org. I'm a fellow at the Brownstone Institute, so you can see my articles there as well. And then I am on X, at Aaron R. Day. So those are the three best places to find me.
Yep. And you're busy reorganizing this right now.
Yes.
Good.
All but right. it's still got all the stuff there. It's just it'll be updated with kind of a new plan.
Yep. Well, I love that it's all about freedom and promoting freedom and free will and all of that. So again, thanks so much for your time today. We'll pick it up next time.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for having me. Bye.